Okay, number two on the second sheet.
How would Srila Prabhupada approach laziness in his disciples to do devotional service? Well, as you would imagine, not very enthusiastically. Yeah, if he saw a disciple being lazy, then he didn't like that. In fact, he told a story actually once. I related this in the fifth volume of my diary. When Prabhupada went to Aligarh, then he was holding 2 days of programs at the place owned by Mr. Surrender Kumar Saigal. He was the owner of a company called Tiger Lock Company. So he's a big man. And he had a big estate. And Prabhupada was giving an afternoon darshan on the lawn. And a few people were there. And Prabhupada told us about an exchange that he had with a man in the 1940s. So this man was criticizing the Vaishnavas that, oh, they're all simply lazy people. All they do is sit down and chant and then eat and sleep. That's all. They don't do anything. So then Prabhupada challenged him. He said, you have not seen a Vaishnava. So then this man responded, no, I've seen. They're all lazy fellows simply eating and sleeping in the name of chanting. Then Prabhupada said, no. He said, you have not seen a real Vaishnava. So then the man said, well, what is that real Vaishnava? So then Prabhupada told him that in the history of India, there were two major wars. One war was the Ram-Ravana war, and the other one was the Kurukshetra war. So in those two wars, then the hero was the Vaishnava. In the Ram-Ravana war, the hero was Hanuman. He's a Vaishnava, although he's a monkey. He's a Vaishnava. And in the Kurukshetra war, the hero was Arjuna. So he's also a Vaishnava. So, in this way then Prabhupada explained that the business of a Vaishnava is to be always very active in serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And not that one simply takes some japa and then in the name of chanting he uses that as an excuse. No, I can't do this, so I can't go out, you know, distributing books today because I'm chanting like that. And Prabhupada said that, you know, he didn't accept that. He said, first of all, you have to be always active and energetic in the service of the Lord. Later on, you may come to the stage where you can actually chant non-stop, Kirtaniya Sadahari. But in the beginning, you have to be always very active in devotional service. So in that way then, Prabhupada stressed many, many times that our temples are not, as he called it, hotels for lazy men. Free hotels for lazy men. We were on a morning walk in Mayapur in 1976. Prabhupada had just arrived. And so the next morning, on the 18th of January, then he was having an inspection tour. So in those days, we didn't have many buildings. There was just the Lotus building. And then at the front, there was the wall with a few rooms on that front wall. And then in the far southwest corner, then there was this very big prasadam hall. And next to that, there was another two-story building, which was, in those days, the kitchen, the main kitchen. And during the festival, then the ladies used to stay in that building also. So anyway, that was the kitchen. So Prabhupada was walking around, he'd gone through the prasadam hall, and then he came into the kitchen area, this two-story building. And then he saw there was some dirt on the steps leading up into the first level. So immediately he stopped. He said, what is this dirt? He said, this place hasn't been cleaned for 300 years. Like this. So then the explanation was given that actually it is cleaned every day, but they clean it in the night time. Because in the morning time, it's hard to get the devotees to do anything because they want to chant japa. So then Prabhupada said, in the name of japa, he said, they are simply sleeping. He said, if it was cleaned in the night time, why is it dirty now first thing in the morning? He said, they're not cleaning. He said, stop this japing. He said, first clean. He said, then make japa. But he said, first clean. Then he warned Jaipataka Maharaj. He said, don't make this a free hotel for lazy men. Anyone who comes here, if he doesn't want to work hard, then he has to go out. But don't allow him. So that's a couple of examples. Prabhupada was very strict about that. He didn't want to see people just in the name of, you know, being a great devotee, just eating and sleeping. That's all. Yeah. You have to work hard. As Prabhupada was working hard. You know, Prabhupada wasn't hardly eating and he wasn't hardly sleeping. He was working day and night, all through the night and all through the day, even at a very advanced age. So he was showing us the standard, and he expected, of course, we may not be able to emulate everything that Prabhupada did. He was only sleeping 3 hours a day, 3-4 hours at the most. We may not be, you know, able to come up to that standard. But at least, you know, the active business of spreading Krishna consciousness, that we have to participate in. Not that we just simply hang around, what we used to call in Australia the ecstasy crew. They all, yeah, they want to dance and chant and eat prasadam. But when you ask them to do some service, oh no, no, sorry Prabhu, I'm too busy. Ecstasy crew. Yeah, so no ecstasy crews. So what can be regarded as Srila Prabhupada's most important instructions? All of them. It's like devotional service. There are 9 items. So all of them equally as important. All of them, you can perfect your business of going back home, back to Godhead, by doing one of them or all of them. Any one of them. The point is that the devotion has to be there when you do them. Hearing, chanting, remembering, offering seva, serving the lotus feet. So many different items are there. So Prabhupada's instructions, all of them, if you take them seriously, they're all important. But out of them, then there are obviously a few that are very important. And the last instruction that I received from Srila Prabhupada personally was at the end of October in 1977. And I think I mentioned last night that I had cleared up what service Prabhupada wanted me to do, that he wanted me in Australia doing management rather than being with him doing his personal service. So at the end of the month, then I went into Prabhupada's room. I discussed with Tamal Krishna Maharaj. You know, there was still a dilemma. I had no dilemma about what, you know, service I was supposed to be doing at that point, because Prabhupada had already told me what he preferred. But at the same time, there was a dilemma in that Srila Prabhupada's, you know, physical condition was rapidly deteriorating. And, you know, this mood was there that he could leave at any time. At the same time, we also had another mood which prevented us from accepting that as a fact, that we couldn't think about Prabhupada leaving. And so we were always thinking, you know, there's a hope that somehow or another he'll recover. You know, Krishna is the Supreme Lord, he can do anything. And so if he wants, then he can heal Prabhupada's body and he'll recover. And he'll be with us for many more years. So I was in this kind of dilemma. If I go back to Australia, then, you know, maybe Prabhupada will leave. At the same time, I was thinking, now if I stay, and Prabhupada's already told me he wants me back there, then he may be with us for many more months. You know, in this condition, he may just go on for many more months. So I couldn't figure out what to do. So I discussed with Srila Prabhupada, with Tamal Krishna, and he made a suggestion that, you know, Satsarupa Maharaj and Atreya Rishi, they've already decided what they're going to do is come for 1 month and then go back to their zone for 1 month. So like that, coming and going. So I thought this is a very good solution. So that, having decided that, then we went into Prabhupada's room. It was evening time, about 7 o'clock. The lights were very dim because at that point Prabhupada's eyes also were not working very well, so he couldn't stand bright light. And maybe somebody was in the room just chanting very softly. So when I went in, I went to one side of the bed where Prabhupada was closest. Tamal Krishna Maharaj went on the other side. And So then I told Srila Prabhupada that I have to go now. You know, my month's up as the visiting secretary. And there was some urgent business in Australia. We were trying to buy a new temple in Sydney. And there were other things going on. So I said, now I'm going to go. I have to leave this evening. But, you know, I'm making this arrangement. I'll come back and I'll see you again in another month. So then when I finished saying that to Srila Prabhupada, he was very quiet. And then he just raised up his hand like this. He was lying on the bed. He put his hand up. He just said, wherever you remain, chant Hare Krishna. And that was it. So that was the last instruction that I got from Srila Prabhupada. And I take that as my most important instruction. That out of all the things that we do, there's many services that you have to do in devotional life. But you get to a point where you can't, you may get to a point where you cannot do any of them anymore. Just as Srila Prabhupada, his physical condition prevented him from doing any of the services that he'd been doing just a few months before. But this one engagement has to always go on. Chant Hare Krishna. So that's the final instruction. Yeah, whatever you're doing, always remember Krishna. And whatever you do, never forget Krishna. This is Rupa Goswami's essence of devotional service. Always remember Krishna, never forget Krishna. So Prabhupada told me that. Wherever you remain, chant Hare Krishna. So that's probably the most important instruction. Because if you're chanting Hare Krishna, then you're remembering Krishna. That's the thing. Did Srila Prabhupada have a private and a public persona? No. The public Prabhupada was the private Prabhupada. There was no difference. You know, it's not that, I mentioned this before, it's not that Prabhupada would come out and give a nice class, tell everybody to be, you know, Krishna conscious, and then go back in his rooms and, you know, throw down his beads, flick on the TV set, you know. Prabhupada was always absorbed in Krishna consciousness day and night. And, you know, a couple of examples, just like when we were in Hawaii in May of 76. So one evening, maybe around about the 12th of May or something, Prabhupada rang the bell about 1 o'clock in the morning. So I jumped up, ran into his room, pushed the Krishna and also he came in. And Prabhupada was just sitting there. He didn't look well. He had a lot of problems with his kidney at that time. One of his kidneys was badly diseased. I'm not sure whether he had a kidney stone or whether it was just not functioning anymore. But he used to suffer from this condition called uremia, where the uric acid is not eliminated because the kidneys don't work. And so it gathers in the extremities of the body. So your feet, the feet and legs, they puff up. Prabhupada's feet used to get very puffy. I could press them down and it would leave a dent in his foot, and then that would be there for like a half hour or an hour before gradually it disappeared, because it was all fluid. And same with his arms and hands as well. They would just puff up with this uric acid. So it's a very painful condition. And has anybody here ever had an experience of kidney problems? Nobody. Yes. What was it like?
Excruciatingly painful.
Kidneys. What was it, a stone or?
It was a stone. It's more painful than childbirth.
Yes. They say that the worst kind of pain is giving birth. But even more than that is having kidney stones and kidney problems. I remember taking a devotee from Melbourne, Chittahari, to the hospital one evening. He got a kidney stone and he phoned me up, "You got to take me to the hospital, I'm going to die." So I went over, he's rolling on the floor in agony, kidney stone. And we rushed him to the hospital and then we had to do an operation. They got a stone as big as a peanut, came out. And another devotee, Sadadanya in Calcutta, he had a kidney stone also. So they had to take him to the hospital. And I asked him afterwards what it was like. And he said, well, he said, there's a special ward in the hospital which is only for kidney patients, nobody else. Because when you have kidney problem, then it's so excruciatingly painful that it doesn't matter how much painkillers they give you, nothing works. You just scream all day. So he said the whole ward is just full of screaming people, yeah, because of the kidney problems. So Prabhupada had, you know, one of his kidneys didn't work. And it was sometimes, even for Prabhupada, it was got to such a point that he couldn't actually do his work. Prabhupada had an incredible tolerance for pain. You know, I don't think anybody could have functioned according to the physical condition that he was in. If they had even one of his conditions, they would not have attempted to do anything like what Prabhupada was doing, traveling all over the world, you know, constantly, every few days on a plane, a new place, giving lectures, meeting people, and translating all through the night. You know, Prabhupada was just an amazingly, you know, tolerant person. But sometimes even he had to stop because of the intense pain that he was getting from his kidneys. So this particular night, he rang the bell, called us in, and he just called us in to tell us that he was in too much, his kidney was giving him too much pain and he couldn't work. Yeah, but he was just sitting there and he was tolerating it. As just, you know, anybody else, they would have been on the floor rolling around in agony, asking to be taken, begging to be taken to the hospital. But Prabhupada just was sitting there very quietly. It was too much for him to be able to work, but other than that, that's all he was doing, just sitting and tolerating. So after telling us that he couldn't work, and he said that I won't go out on my morning walk in the morning as usual, then he started telling us about what he was translating in the Bhagavatam. And he preached to us for about an hour, from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock, just telling us what, you know, the preaching the philosophy and what he was reading in the Bhagavatam. And then he sent us back to sleep again. So the point is that Prabhupada couldn't stop talking about Krishna. Yeah? Whatever condition that he was in, any opportunity, you know, and this was just personal servant, secretary, we were with him 24 hours. But having called us in, all right, now speak about Krishna. So, you know, that was Prabhupada's private and public persona. He was simply speaking about Krishna 24 hours a day, non-stop. Yeah. When George Harrison came to see him in London on the 26th of July, then they were having some discussion. And at one point, George asked Srila Prabhupada where he found the time for writing. Prabhupada had just presented him with a couple of volumes, the new volume of the Bhagavatam, 7th canto, 3rd part. And he gave that to George, and then I think he gave him a couple of other volumes. And George, you know, was just expressing his appreciation and amazement. He said that there's just so much, so many books. He said, you know, I can't find the time to read them, what to speak about, you know, how much time it must take to write them, I can't imagine. So then Prabhupada left and he said, I write in the night. And he said, actually, he said, I don't sleep. He said, I don't like to sleep. He said, when I go to sleep, then I think, now I'm going to waste my time. He said, I actually think like that. So Prabhupada, he would sleep 1 hour after breakfast, 1 hour after lunch. If you have a 1 hour nap, that's not sleeping. You don't get into what they call, you know, the deep sleep stage. And you could see Prabhupada was just resting his body, that's all. You know, the body has to be, you know, dealt with carefully if it's to last. So it needs some rest. So he would rest his body an hour after lunch, an hour after breakfast, and in the evening the same thing. He'd take rest for an hour or an hour and a half. Many times I massaged him, you know, for 3/4 of an hour or an hour. And as soon as I stopped massaging and went out, he would immediately get up and then sit down and begin working. And he'd go all the way through till 5 o'clock in the morning. And sometimes I saw in Hawaii, especially because Prabhupada had gone to Hawaii for 1 month especially to do get Maharaja chair, especially to do extra work on his writing. And so again, another evening, this was on Ekadasi evening actually, Prabhupada rang the bell about 9:15, which was early. And so I thought maybe he's, you know, going to take his milk early and then have his rest and then get on with his work. But when I went into his room, I saw he was already sitting there with the dictaphone in his hand, and he was already working. And then he just, you know, when I walked in, he said, "I'm not going to take rest tonight, so don't bother with the milk or anything and the massage." He said, "I want to get this finished." He was just about to finish the seventh canto. And so that was it. He just worked all the way through. He never took rest. And then a couple of other nights, the same thing. He didn't take any rest at all. He just, you know, he was working virtually 24 hours a day. So that was the private Śrīla Prabhupāda that we saw. Exactly the same as the public one. No difference. Okay, next question. I believe that we have to read Bhagavad Gita, then Srimad Bhagavatam, then Chaitanya Charitamrita. Why did Śrīla Prabhupāda ask the Westerners to begin reading the Srimad Bhagavatam that he had taken with him? Who wrote that question? Who asked this question? What was, I'm not quite sure what you're asking then. Well, okay, when Prabhupada first went to the West, he didn't have a Bhagavad Gita. He had a manuscript, but he didn't have it printed. But he had three volumes of the Bhagavatam, first canto, that were already published. They were printed, 1,100 copies each. And when Prabhupada left to go to the West, he had about 200 sets of his books that were shipped for, actually, he joined the ship in Calcutta on King George's dock on Friday the 13th, September. And then the ship sailed around to Sri Lanka, and he dropped off a half a day there in Colombo. And actually the ship's captain, Mr. Pandya, he took Prabhupada in a taxi, actually. They hired a taxi, and he took him around Colombo. And then from there, they went round the tip of India, and then they came around the other coast to Cochin. And in Cochin, then Prabhupada's cargo of these 200 sets of books were actually loaded on, because they'd been sent down from Bombay by his agent. So when Prabhupada came to the West, that's what he came with. He had one little trunk with his clothes in, and he had several trunks with 200 sets of his Bhagavatams in. And that's basically how he survived in the first year. You know, he had 3 weeks in Sally Agarwal's house, Sally and Gopal's house in Butler. And then after that, then he was on his own. You know, Sally Agarwal said that when Prabhupada left them, he said, "Now I'm going up to New York." She was completely fearful, what's going to happen to him? Yeah, they'd gotten very fond of him, obviously. Prabhupada was very, you know, he's a person that you could get very quickly attached to. And so Sally Agarwal was thinking, you know, now Swamiji's going off to New York. New York is like this ferocious place, you know. And he has no money and he has no friends, practically. What is he going to do? But Prabhupada, you know, he was there to preach. He wasn't there to, you know, make friends and live in other people's houses. You know, he was off to preach. So he stopped off in Pennsylvania at the university there and, you know, gave a lecture there. Then from there he went to New York. So how was he surviving in New York? He was selling his books. He would go out in the daytime. He was staying with this Dr. Mishra, who was a Mayavadi yoga teacher. So he, for some time he stayed with him. And then in the daytime, he, what was he doing? He wasn't just hanging out. He was busy. Yeah, he was going out. He would find out where all the bookstores were, Paragon and Doubleday and all these places. And he would go there with a set of his books. He would speak with them. He would give them some samosas. Yeah. And then this was his selling method. Soften them up with prasadam, and then, you know. And then he would persuade them to take a set of his books. And people were actually buying them. You know, I don't know. Well, anyway, you know, they were Indian prints. You know, they weren't like up to the Western standard. But maybe people thought, you know, these are a little different. You know, some kind of antique book, you know, unusual. So they would buy them for that. And then they would read them, and then it would have its effect. Prabhupada's purports. Prabhupada actually said that when he wrote the first canto, he wasn't sure whether he would live to finish the rest. So what he tried to do was give the essence of Krishna consciousness in the purports to the first canto. Like all the basic necessities are all there in that first canto. So, you know, he was thinking ahead. Prabhupada was a very careful person. So, you know, he was surviving by selling a few books here and there. And then gradually he met, you know, different people, friends that would help him and support him. But he had this manuscript. And actually he had heaps of manuscripts. And Hayagriva describes that after he first met Prabhupada, he saw him walking along the street on 26 Second Avenue. And they lived just around the corner on Mott Street. Him and Kirtananda and Umapati and Achyutananda and a few others. So he was walking along one day and he saw this Indian sannyasi on the other side of the road. And Hayagriva and Kirtananda had just returned from India. And Prabhupada had come to America on the Jaladuta. These men came back from they went to India on the Jaladuta. Same boat, actually, just by some transcendental coincidence. And they'd gone there looking for a guru. And then they came back disappointed. And then in 26 Second Avenue, they meet Srila Prabhupada. Right? So, you know, Hayagriva says he went up to Prabhupada and he didn't know what to say. He was just so amazed to see, you know, this, you know, gentleman, Indian gentleman, dressed in sannyasi clothes, walking down the street on 26 Second Avenue in the Bowery area, you know, horrible place. And he said, when I went up to him, I just asked him, "Are you from India?" As if he couldn't be, you know. And, you know, Prabhupada had his little white rubber pointy slippers and his cane, and he said, "Oh yes, and you?" And so they struck a good conversation, and Prabhupada said, "I'm giving lectures on the Bhagavad Gita. I have a place, 26 Second Avenue. Would you like to come and see it?" Prabhupada wanted his opinion. He just met him. And then immediately asked him, "Would you like to come and see it and tell me what you think about it? Do you think this will be a good place for giving Bhagavad Gita classes?" And Hayagriva, you know, he didn't know anything, but he said, "Well, yeah, it looks very nice." So then Prabhupada said, "So then you will come?" And so he agreed, and then he said, "And you bring your friends also." So he agreed again. And then, you know, Prabhupada was doing Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays. Yeah. In the evenings, he had a little sign up, Bhagavad Gita classes, Bhagavad Gita as it is. So Prabhupada was preaching the Bhagavad Gita right from the beginning, but then he didn't have it out in printed form. So that was the first project that he engaged Hayagriva in. Hayagriva, you know, asked Prabhupada, he saw Prabhupada was sitting there and typing, and Hayagriva, you know, he was a good typist. So he thought, maybe I can help Swamiji, you know, with some typing work. And he asked Srila Prabhupada, he said, "Actually, you know, I'm a professor of English, you know, so is this something I can help you with?" So then Prabhupada said, "Oh yes." He said, "I have some stuff I'm typing here, maybe you can edit it." Or Hayagriva offered to edit it. So then Prabhupada said, "Oh yes, very nice." He said, "I have some other stuff, would you like to do that as well?" So he said, "Oh, sure." So Prabhupada opens up the closet. There's a stack of like 2,000 pages. that Prabhupada had been typing away, and he had them tied up in saffron cloth bundles, you know, and he brought them with him. And so that was what he was doing. And then Hayagriva said he was amazed how much work there was there. He couldn't believe it. But that was the first project that they did. They worked on the Bhagavad Gita and getting that, you know, into suitable shape so that it could be published. And then they set about trying to find a publisher for it because they had no money. Eventually they got Collier Macmillan, Penguin, actually, to publish the first edition. But they wouldn't do the full unabridged edition. They would only do an abridged version. And so Prabhupada had to cut his manuscript down to about one third of the size. So you can imagine how he felt, you know, that most of his purports were being chopped out. But just to get it into print, he did it. Then later on, when, you know, things started becoming a little bit successful, devotees were joining, they started selling his books, and he wanted to set up the BBT, then he retained the right, very intelligently, he retained the right to the full Bhagavad Gita. And so then he published the unabridged edition, and the devotees... Oh no, Macmillan started it, they published it, that's what... What happened was that they were only doing the abridged edition. Then Prabhupada, after a certain point, then he was going to withdraw unless they did the full edition. So then they agreed finally, after a lot of wrangling, to do the full edition. Then when Prabhupada set up the BBT, then he wanted, you know, to publish his own Bhagavad Gita and get the rights back. But Macmillan wouldn't give them because they were still selling, because it was our devotees that were selling them. And as long as they were getting sales, they weren't going to give back the rights, you know, for publication to Prabhupada. So Prabhupada employed another tactic. He stopped the devotees from selling the unabridged edition. So Macmillan, they weren't getting any sales anymore. And then somehow or another, I think Prabhupada had given a limited agreement for the abridged edition, and that ran out. So to get back the rights to the unabridged edition, he stopped the devotees from selling it. That meant Macmillan were not getting any more sales. And then he had, in the meantime, to keep the distribution going, he reprinted the abridged edition, even though he didn't like it. But he reprinted it and had the devotees sell that, so we would still be doing preaching and selling the Gita. And then after a couple of years, Macmillan saw, now we're not going to get anything more from this. So they surrendered and they gave back the rights to the unabridged. And then Prabhupada immediately switched back over to the unabridged edition. Anyway, these are all tactics. Yeah. But the point is that in the beginning, there were no books except the Bhagavatam. I remember Sadama Maharaj. He was the first black American devotee to take sannyas. He was a dancer and very talented person in many ways. Professional he was, an actor. And he had joined, and he was like, they were living some hippie commune. I think the Lone Star Ranch in Northern California. There was a whole bunch of devotees actually came from Lone Star Ranch.
Morning Star Ranch.
And Prabhupada had gone up there to do a program. It was a kind of a very, you know, extreme place. There were people living naked in trees. Hippies trying to get back to nature. Yeah. Yeah, they were trying to be spiritual, and so they were trying to tune in, you know, to nature. So they were literally living naked in the trees. And Prabhupada went in the middle of all of that, you know, did a program. And out of that, we got several, you know, prominent devotees. So anyway, Sadama, he was living in some hut or something. And whatever he was doing, somehow or another, he found himself in this hut in the forest. And he's just hanging out. And, you know, as all of them, they were all high as kites on LSD and, you know, so many other things. And he just found this book in this hut, and it was one of Prabhupada's Bhagavatams. So he just thought, wow, you know, this is some ancient book, It looked like it was hundreds of years old, right? Because it had been printed in India. So he thought he'd come across some, you know, like really ancient, mysterious, you know, treasure. So he started reading it, and that was it. You know, when he started reading the Bhagavatam, he understood immediately, and he came down to San Francisco and he joined. So, you know, the potency was there. But in general, Prabhupada said, you know, read the Gita, read the Bhagavatam, then the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And the Nectar of Devotion, he said, these four books, these are the most important books to read. And when I first joined in Sydney in 72, we were actually forbidden to read the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. Because we didn't have the Chaitanya Charitamrita out at that time, but the summary study was the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. But we were told, this is too advanced for you, you're not to read it. So we had to just read the Bhagavad Gita to start with, and Bhagavatam. Oh, we had, Hanuman was there. He was a French-Canadian, he took sannyas just after that. And Mohanananda was the temple president, Upendra was there. But that was the thing, that, you know, there was this thing in ISKCON in the early days that, you know, don't read works that are too advanced for you. So teachings of Lord Chaitanya was considered too advanced for a neophyte. So first of all, learn, you know, the basics. I mean, when I joined, I'd understood that Krishna was God, but that was it. You know, I'd never heard of Lord Shiva. I remember several months after I joined, I got somebody to, you know, explain to me who Lord Shiva was. You know, we just didn't know very much. So there was a progression, and in general, it's nice to follow that. But Prabhupada was very practical, and in situations where you use whatever's available, that's all. It will all have some effect. All right? Okay, let's see. Very often devotees are called upon to render devotional service, especially in preparation for big festivals. Is it okay to sacrifice chanting for devotional service, especially when the need for service is very immediate? Generally not, but sometimes it was allowed. It's not a principle of devotional service that, you know, you give up chanting so you can do something else. Although in some circumstances, Prabhupada would overlook a devotee not chanting. Two incidences I can think of is when Hansa Dutta was in the first party that went to India. So when they arrived there, then immediately it was a sensation. 30 Western, you know, Vaishnavas, men and women, saris, dhotis, shaved head, tilak, chanting Hare Krishna, and preaching Bhagavatam, you know, giving, you know, lectures to pandals to thousands of people. So it was a sensation. And as soon as they arrived, then immediately they were being invited to go to this place, that place, and do programs. And sometimes they were doing 3, 4, even 5 programs in a day. So they were running flat out from morning till night. So after a couple of months, Hansa Dutta went to Srila Prabhupada. And he said, Srila Prabhupada, he said, you know, we're so busy doing all these programs, I'm not getting my rounds done. I don't have any time to chant my rounds because we're just working from morning till night. So Prabhupada, he said, that's all right. He said, this is an emergency. So I excused him from doing that. But in normal circumstances, of course, he would, you know, chastise us for not chanting. And another incident was when Shyamasunda Prabhu, he was, because he was one of the first ones to open up our London preaching, English preaching. And then gradually he became the GBC there. He became Prabhupada's secretary and then he was the GBC. And so he was also working very hard, morning and night, you know, running here and there, getting all the things set up, getting Buri Place, which was the first temple. He was personally building everything. He built the altar himself and he did all these nice wooden archways to make it look like a proper temple. So he was working flat out. So again, some other devotees went to Srila Prabhupada and they said, Prabhupada, Shyamasunda is not chanting his rounds. And, you know, because they were a bit dubious because he wasn't chanting his rounds. They thought, well, why should we, you know, follow his instructions? Because there may have been other things, elements involved in that as well. But they went to Prabhupada to complain. So then Prabhupada said, that's all right. He said he is working hard. He said, just like Arjuna, you know, he wasn't chanting his rounds. He was fighting a war. So he excused him. Of course, Shyamasundar, you know, had problems later on. He left for quite a long time, probably because he wasn't chanting his rounds. And people that I've practically observed, you know, that don't chant their rounds, after some time, that's it, they go away. You can't just work, work, work. You have to get some juice. You have to get a taste. And you get the taste from chanting the holy names. And if you're not, if you don't have sufficient taste to be able to chant the holy names, Prabhupada said that means you're in a diseased condition of spiritual life. So sometimes devotees, you know, they don't want to chant, they don't have a taste for chanting, so they just work. But after some time, that work becomes very dry. And then they also, then they leave. So in some circumstances, if there's a real emergency, maybe one day, just like when Prabhupada came to Australia in Melbourne for the Rathiatra in 1974. So we were frantically trying to get the chariots prepared in time for the festival. And we were working out on some vacant plot of land miles away from the temple. There was me and Gauramandala Bhumi. And we were living in a little tent on the work site. And, you know, morning till night, from, you know, getting up in the morning to 11 o'clock at night, sometimes we were working. The last few nights, we had to literally work all night long so that we would have the chariots ready. Two or three nights we did that. And there was just no time to chant. We were just flat out from, you know, the moment that we woke up till late at night. And I remember going into the temple one morning because, you know, Prabhupada had arrived and he was staying for a week, and the Rath festival was going to be towards the end of the week, of, you know, the end of his stay. So Prabhupada had been in Melbourne for 3 days and I hadn't even seen him because, you know, we were just out at the Rath site all day and night. So one morning I just decided I have to take a break and go and see Srila Prabhupada. This is ridiculous. He's been here 3 days. Everybody else is there having huge kirtans. Prabhupada was going out and doing programs at different places. And, you know, all the devotees were all buzzing with energy and enthusiasm. And there we were stuck out at the Rath Ghat and, you know, missing out on the nectar. So I went in one morning for the morning program. Or at least, you know, Guru Puja and then class. So during the Guru Puja, then I was feeling actually very miserable because I hadn't been chanting my rounds. And everybody was chanting, all the Sankirtan devotees were there, the book distributors, and they were all having this Wampastapa Kirtan. And Prabhupada was sitting on the Vyasasana playing his kartals and really enjoying the whole thing. And I'm there and I'm trying to kind of do it, and it felt completely artificial. You know, I had no taste at all. And I was, you know, I just felt like I was like an imposter or something, you know. That I didn't really feel like I was a devotee even. But I was there and I knew that I should chant, you know, as a matter of principle. So I was trying, but it was kind of half-hearted. And halfway through the kirtan, I just remember turning and looking towards Srila Prabhupada. He was sitting on the Vyasasana. And just at that moment, he looked directly at me. And I just felt like, you know, I'd been put in an MRI or something, you know. In those days it was x-rays. Nowadays it's MRIs. And, you know, that Prabhupada looked at me and he could see everything. You know, he knew exactly what a nonsense I was. You know, he could see, you know. Anyway, just like a moment. And then the kirtan went on. Then in his class, then Prabhupada gave this nice class about chanting Hare Krishna. And then at a certain point, he said, it doesn't matter. He said, even if you think it's artificial, you should do it anyway. And I knew he was, because everybody else knew that he was talking to them as well, but I especially knew that he was talking to me. And I just felt that Prabhupada had seen what was going on and he was encouraging me. He didn't know me at that time. You know, this was in the early days. But he just said, even if you think it's even if it feels like it's artificial, do it anyway. It will purify. It will have its effect. So I felt very encouraged just from that one little statement and that, you know, that incident. But the thing is, don't take it as a principle or, you know, it's okay if we have too much work. Because then, at a certain point, you may get to the, you know, situation where you say, well, work is more important. Doesn't matter if you chant or not. And then afterwards, then you'll leave. That's what will be the end result. So always chant your rounds as much as is possible. But in some circumstances, it may be permitted. Yeah. Okay, so next question. Many people outside ISKCON think that we place too much of an emphasis on Srila Prabhupada. Some saying, like it's the International Society for Prabhupada Consciousness. So how do we present Srila Prabhupada to them? Well, I think that, you know, because that's a completely false impression. The one thing that Prabhupada didn't do was present himself. You see, all the other groups that were, you know, forming in you know, the 60s and 70s, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's group, Bal Yogi's group, Muktananda's group, and the Hare Krishna's. Not the Prabhupada group, you know, the Bhaktivedanta Swami group. We were the Hare Krishna's. Because Prabhupada put all of our focus on worshipping Krishna, not on himself. All the other yogis and gurus, all their organizations were all about themselves. Yeah, Yogananda's group, Muktananda's group, Chinmayananda's group. Everybody knew all these big gurus. But Prabhupada wasn't so well known. But the Hare Krishnas were, you know, known internationally everywhere. Everybody had heard of Hare Krishna. But nobody knew about the personality that was behind it all. So, you know, as Prabhupada's disciples and grand disciples, naturally, we want to recognize Prabhupada's contribution. He himself wasn't interested in advertising himself. But the disciple of a guru is naturally interested in glorifying his spiritual master. So it's natural that we would want to glorify Srila Prabhupada, because look at what he did. You know, he created some, you know, this unbelievable worldwide spiritual movement, which has outlasted every other one. So why we should, you know, glorify Srila Prabhupada? We should be conscious of Srila Prabhupada. And Krishna himself says, you know, that I'm not in the heart of those who claim to be my devotees. I'm not in the heart of the yogis, but I'm in the hearts of my devotees. And those who claim to be my devotees are not my devotees. But those who are devotees of my devotees, they are my devotees. Yeah. So Krishna's mood is that he recognizes his devotees and wants his devotees to be praised and worshipped more than himself. He feels happier with that. So if we worship Srila Prabhupada, if we, you know, glorify Srila Prabhupada, actually we get more benefit from that than we do if we're directly worshipping Krishna and praising Krishna. Because Krishna becomes more pleased. Not that Krishna's out of the picture. Yeah. Because you can't separate Srila Prabhupada from Krishna. You can only praise and worship Srila Prabhupada in the context of, you know, his being a devotee of Krishna. But if we glorify Prabhupada more, then Krishna becomes even more happy with us. This is a fact. It's a spiritual fact. So don't worry about it being the International Society for Prabhupada Consciousness. If we're not conscious of Srila Prabhupada, then we're doomed. Yeah, he's the founder of charity. So, okay, next question, quick one. Please tell us how it was to be in the presence of an extraordinary personality. It was extraordinary. I mean, it was. Prabhupada was an extraordinary personality, and nobody that came in his presence could be failed to be moved by him. Yeah, you see, even people, even though they didn't become devotees, but professors, parents of devotees that may have just had one meeting with Srila Prabhupada, but it left an indelible impression on them. Yeah. Nobody could come and meet with Srila Prabhupada and go away thinking this is an ordinary person. Yeah, nothing happening here. Just the purity of Prabhupada's personality, his, you know, strength of conviction about what he was doing, his knowledge about what he was doing, and just his mannerisms, how he dealt with people in such an expert way. Even sometimes some, you know, parents of devotees would come, they would be angry. Yeah, because their devotee, their sons or daughters have become devotees, and they would come to complain to Srila Prabhupada. It happened a couple of times in the early days. But when they came before Srila Prabhupada, he was so nice and so charming that they couldn't be angry with him. And then they, you know, they give up the purpose that they came from and kind of like begrudgingly accept that actually it's all right, you know, for my son to be a devotee. This happened with Gagamuni and Brahmananda, two brothers. Brahmananda joined, and then afterwards Gagamuni came. So, you know, the parents were upset. First they lost one son, alright, they tolerated that. But then their second son as well. So the mother became very upset. So she came to Srila Prabhupada, that you've already got one of my sons, you can't have both. But Prabhupada was so nice. And he had Brahmananda, when she came in, he had them bow down and offer their obeisances to their mother. Right? And of course, this is unprecedented. In India it happens. But in the West, you know, somebody, oh, mother, your son, you know. She didn't know what to say, you know. So how could she argue with that, you know, that by their association with Srila Prabhupada, now her sons, you know, were bowing down and touching her feet, you know, and praising her like this. So she couldn't say anything. So in the end, she just laughed. She said, oh, what can I do? So Prabhupada was, he was an extraordinary personality in many, many different ways. And I can say that, you know, out of the 34 years that I've been a devotee, but that 1.5 year period, you know, that I spent with Srila Prabhupada, you know, that is my whole life, practically. Because everything that I do is kind of, I automatically relate everything back to when I was with Srila Prabhupada. I can't help it. There you go, confirmed. Srila Prabhupada chanting Hare Krishna. You know, it's just automatic. That was a period in my life where I experienced something that I've never experienced before or since, even as a devotee. You know, the intensity of, you know, devotional life with Srila Prabhupada. It was exceptional. And you had to be, you know, there's a certain state of consciousness that you had to be in if you wanted to be able to stay with him. Because he was in such a, you know, high state of Krishna consciousness himself. There was no question of you being in Maya and staying around Srila Prabhupada. You know, you couldn't like wake up one morning and think, oh, you know, I don't really feel like, you know, I want to do this. Or I don't want to, you know, go to the temple this morning, or I think I'll sleep in, or, you know. There was no question of, you know, like moods, feeling okay one day and not so okay the next day. You had to be, you know, in like complete, open, ready for action, Krishna consciousness, every moment of every day that you were with Prabhupada. For us, it was an effort, and that's why many devotees couldn't last very long as Prabhupada's servants. I mean, if you think, you know, I had 16 months with him. It's not very long. 16 months is not very long. But when you were with Prabhupada, it was like eternity. You know? And so, you know, naturally that had a tremendous impact on my consciousness. It's probably the only period of my life that I ever did anything really worthwhile, you know, was when I was with Prabhupada. But by, you know, good fortune, of course, I've been able to extend that association by writing about him. I was able to keep that diary. And by, you know, talking about Prabhupada. And, you know, that's actually what gives me life. And if I couldn't do that, then, you know, there wouldn't be any life. So, you know, Prabhupada transformed people's lives in very real and practical ways. And, you know, once you've experienced that transformation, you can't forget it. You know, even like in the Bhagavatam, it says that if a person once has tasted the dust of the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, even if he falls away from his standard, he's never to be considered a karma. Yeah, because he's had that taste, and you can't experience that anywhere else. So the experiences that we have with Prabhupada, you can't get from anywhere else. Yeah. So whatever happens, I mean, you know, devotees have been with Prabhupada and then have fallen away. They've had struggles, and, you know, quite a few servants and secretaries kind of drifted off, you know, fell into Maya in different ways. But the fact is that, you know, Prabhupada has remained the center point of their lives. And they come back. Upendra, he was one. Sudama, I mentioned, he's another. So many of them. You know, but at the end, they all come back, because that's it. Once Prabhupada got you, you're finished. Your whole material life is completely finished. You know, there may be some, you know, dregs, some material desires hanging on a little bit, but actually it's finished. That's the fact. And we're finished. It's 9 o'clock. So I'm sorry that there are a couple of other questions, some other questions, a few other questions. Maybe let me just see if I can do it really, really quick. There's two or three. Please explain how best to serve Srila Prabhupada. What pleases Prabhupada the most? Prabhupada said that very clearly. If you want to please me, then distribute my books. Said, if you really want to please me, then do as I am doing. This is what he told the devotees in Los Angeles. Do as I am doing. Preach Krishna consciousness. If you really want to please Prabhupada, preach Krishna consciousness. Is it stated in the scriptures why there is a material world? Why does Krishna make one when the spiritual world is full of bliss? Because we have a choice. This was the answer Prabhupada gave several times. You know, if we were with Krishna in the spiritual world and it's all so blissful, why did we leave? Yeah. And Prabhupada said, why do people go to jail? You have a choice. You're living in the free society. But by choice, you do some nonsense and then you have to be put in jail. Material world is a jail. Spiritual world is free life. Yeah. But we have a choice. And if there was no choice, then there'd be no love. Because love means voluntarily giving yourself for the pleasure of the beloved. So Krishna doesn't force us to love it. It's not mechanical that he makes all these little robots that so that he can have different leelas with them. Yeah, you can't have leelas and rasa with robots. Yeah, when there's a personality who loves you and gives everything and does everything for you, then you feel enlivened and you want to do everything for them. And that's the exchange. That's bhakti. So the spiritual world is bhakti. That means voluntarily. Even though we're parts and parcels of Krishna, we're not forced to surrender to Krishna. We're not forced to love Krishna. Yeah? But we do it because Krishna is so wonderful. But sometimes, because we have that option to not do it, sometimes the bewildered soul, the soul can become bewildered and think, why should I? And as soon as he thinks, why should I? Boom. You have to go somewhere where you can live out that fantasy. Why should I? Why not me? Why not me be the controller and the enjoyer and the possessor? Why should Krishna be? That's our independence, to think like that. And as soon as we want to think like that, Krishna makes a place for us so that we can think like that. That's Krishna's mercy. Yeah. If you want to compete with Krishna, sorry, you can't do that in the spiritual world. So then you, there has to be some place. Krishna gives us, that's the material world. That's why he makes it. So it's a temporary place. And it's just so we can live out some fantasies, that's all. But at the same time, Krishna wants us to come back to him. So he tries to make so many arrangements so that we can do that. So, and then the last one, can't read the writing here. Did you, something, Prabhupada, experience ecstatic symptoms? Or did you witness Srila Prabhupada experience ecstatic symptoms of, or visions of Krishna? Please tell us about it. Well, the first time I went to Mayapur was in 75 for the festival there. And Prabhupada gave his first lecture. There were about 500 devotees that came for that festival. It was the biggest one up to that date. Prabhupada was giving a lecture on the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And as he was lecturing, he started talking about the mercy of Lord Chaitanya. And then he started saying that now this is the great mercy of Lord Chaitanya, that so many of you have come from so many different places in the world here to the birthplace of Lord Chaitanya. And as Prabhupada was speaking like that, then he started choking up. And then he just stopped in mid-sentence. And he was just sitting there and he was completely, he went into an ecstatic trance. And we're all just sitting there watching and nobody knew what to do. Then after about a minute, then Hansadutra, I think it was, he started chanting Hare Krishna. And when he started chanting, then that brought Srila Prabhupada back to external consciousness. And then, you know, as soon as he came to external consciousness, then he said, all right, Hare Krishna, thank you. And that was the end of the lecture. So that was one time. In general, Prabhupada didn't exhibit ecstatic symptoms. But in the end period, the last couple of months, then we saw that tendency to come out more and more. Prabhupada had finished his preaching lila. He was in this Nirjana Bhajan stage. And devotees were coming to see him, and you know, for many of them, it was the last time that they would see Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada, on numerous occasions, began crying when, you know, different devotees came in and he heard about their preaching. He would become ecstatic and he would start crying, and you know, he would praise them for the work that they were doing. So that wasn't, you know, the normal thing. But at the end there, then, you know, that the exchanges were intensifying like anything. So there were some occasions when I saw that practically. There was one final thing. One incident that I experienced when I was with Prabhupada, we'd been in his room. It was in Mayapur in 76, and Hari Kesh was discussing the fifth canto. And the fifth canto had kind of come out the year before, and it was very puzzling for a lot of devotees to try to work out the description of the universe, especially the thing about the moon being further away than the sun, about the planet Bhumandala, and you know, the seven kinds of oceans and the mountain ranges and all this kind of stuff. Very difficult to figure anything out at all. So Hari Kesh was complaining that some of the original diagrams that the editors had included in that canto to kind of, you know, give a visual description of the verses were not correct. Some people were complaining that they're not being depicted correctly. So he was discussing with Prabhupada about the fifth canto, and Prabhupada was trying to explain, you know, the general situation in the universe. And he gave the example of the chandelier and how, you know, the pole star was in the middle and all the planets are moving around the pole star. And then the sun is moving around all the planets in its own orbit. So like this for about half an hour or so, there was some discussion. And then we got to a point where we actually just couldn't, you know, understand anything more that Prabhupada was trying to tell us. So then he stopped. So then Prabhupada got up to go out the room and go to the bathroom. So as he was getting up, he was smiling. You know, we just had this very intense conversation with him. And I was sitting there looking at him. And as Prabhupada got up, he just started to glow. And I saw this effulgence just coming out from it, emanating. And it just filled up the whole room. And everything else just kind of disappeared. And I could just see Srila Prabhupada and this effulgence. And it wasn't that Prabhupada was doing anything in particular, like anything special. He was just getting up and, you know, going out the door. But I think I just somehow or another my consciousness just opened up momentarily. And I actually, you know, saw this other, you know, this effulgence coming from Srila Prabhupada. And I just experienced this moment of, you know, like complete and total surrender, where I had, you know, no material desire, nothing going on in my mind. There was just me and Prabhupada, you know, and I just felt totally, fully surrendered and satisfied, you know, in that surrender. I mean, normally, you know, we always have something going on in our minds. Yeah, we're not like totally surrendered, where everything, all the distractions and all the anattas and all the little things in the back of the mind have just totally disappeared. But I had that one moment when I experienced that with Srila Prabhupada, just full, absolute surrender. And then it, you know, it closed down again, and then it was like back to normal. And Yadavara told me that he had a similar experience in Rishikesh in 1977. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj had a similar experience right in the last 2 weeks, when the whole debate about whether Prabhupada would go on parikrama or not, you know, in November of 77 was going on. And, you know, Prabhupada just brought them to a point of extreme anxiety whether he was going to go or not go. And there was two camps, one that wanted him to go because he didn't ask for it, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj and the personal servants that didn't want him to go because they knew it would kill him as soon as, you know, within 2 hours on a bullock cart, he would be dead. So they, you know, they wanted him to wait till he recovered, and there was this intense argument going on. And then finally they came down, Bhavananda and Tamal Krishna Maharaj. They came into Prabhupada's room. He had sent for them. And Babaji Maharaj was there, Krishnadas Babaji, Kinshana Krishnadas. And they came in, and Tamal Krishna Maharaj told me, he said, we were at our wit's end with anxiety. And I just pleaded with Srila Prabhupada not to go out on this bullock cart. And, you know, he was crying. And then he said, at that moment, I had this experience of, you know, total, absolute surrender to Srila Prabhupada. That, you know, that's all I wanted was just Srila Prabhupada's interest, nothing else. And he said, actually, he said, I had prayed for that, that I could experience that at some point. And Krishna very mercifully, you know, gave me that experience. So he had that. So one or two people, you know, experienced that. And not just a few, sometimes it happened en masse as well. My wife told me the first time she saw Srila Prabhupada was at the Detroit airport. There were about 150 or 200 devotees there to greet him. Huge gathering. And Prabhupada came into the airport, and as soon as everybody saw him, everybody burst into tears. Everybody. It's like this, you know, transcendental emotion just went out in the whole airport. Just, and Prabhupada wasn't, you know, again, doing anything special. He just came in. He was who he was. But somehow or another, everybody, when they saw him, they just all burst into tears. They offered their obeisances, and, you know, they just were overwhelmed by Prabhupada's presence. So, you know, sometimes you get little glimpses of the character of a pure devotee. You get these little experiences. It gives us a little taste of what it must be like, you know, to be with Krishna in Vrindavan, Goloka Vrindavan, for eternity. They're always in this kind of bliss. Yeah, most of the time we're just under the modes of nature and afflicted by our minds and our senses, and, you know, we don't experience that. We get little glimpses. Okay, that's it. It's very late. I'm sorry to go on. We have 45 minutes to get breakfast and then get out of our rooms. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada.